Mike Commodore is here in studio. He's hanging out for a couple of weeks. Excellent. And wherever it seems like the one thing that people notice is they believe that you and he sound very much alike. So I'm very curious to maybe you guys could have a little conversation about things. And we'll,
Sure. Good morning, Stephen. How you doing?
Yeah, there's some similarities there. That's what do you think?
Yeah, it sounds pretty similar to me. I was telling these guys, you're an intelligent guy. I'm going to be taking credit for everything you say today. It's going to be all out of me.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. It's amazing. There's a career in this. You could voice some videos, man. I'm telling you. You'd be surprised what you can do with that.
I'd love to. Be better than the Triton telecommunications trying to do now.
There it is.
No, I'm just kidding. I love Triton.
Now, Stephen, I want to start with obviously the big tennis story. Eric Francis was on with Peter Klein yesterday, and he was talking about what's the bigger sports story? Is it the Raptors or is it Bianca Andreescu? How big is this story as it would compare to an Olympic multi-medal winning performance? I don't know. Everyone wants to compare it. Do you compare it to anything in its significance?
I've been struggling, you know, to find the absolute comparison because I'm not sure I have one. I go way back, so I've got a few examples that of, you know, kind of moments when it felt like everybody was watching the same thing at the same time, or, you know, proudly patriotic Canadian sports moments, or, you know, individual achievements or team achievements, or, you know, take your pick, right? But I think that the difference with this one, you know, the reason it's different than, say, Mike Weir winning the Masters, or, you know, even big Olympic moments, or, you know, team stuff is a little bit different because you know, invariably you play out a whole season, right? But I think that the difference with this one is how quickly Bianca Andreescu kind of came into kind of the national imagination, right? It's most people don't follow tennis. There are hardcore tennis fans in this country, but most people do not follow tennis outside of the majors and maybe outside of the Rogers Cup. So when she won Indian Wells back in the spring, which is a big tournament, you know, a huge tournament, maybe the biggest tournament outside of the majors, I'm not sure how many people, you know, kind of tweaked to that. But, you know, even tennis people, she was the 152nd ranked player in the world starting this year. And, you know, she went over pre-Australian Open. She beat Carolyn Wozniacki in Auckland. She beat Venus Williams in Auckland. But that's, you know, that's off almost everybody's radar. Almost even tennis fans, it's kind of off their radar. She wins Indian Wells, which is a big deal for tennis fans, but again, doesn't really kind of creep into the general conversation. And then she gets hurt. So she, you know, drops out of the French, doesn't play at Wimbledon, comes back, and this starts to roll when she wins in Toronto at the Rogers Cup. And of course, the kind of the moment with Serena after that match, after Serena pulled out. So, you know, this is like even an Olympian, you kind of, you know, there's all that talk going into an Olympics. You know, they're not necessarily sports that people follow, but we certainly build them up within heading to the Olympic Games and within the Olympic Games. So, you know, who the medal hopes are, the medal favorites are. But this thing just steamrolled in the course of a few weeks. You know, the Rogers Cup was a month ago. And, you know, that's kind of when this dawned on people. So, you know, to go from that to 2.5 million people watching a tennis match on a Saturday afternoon is, and kind of realizing that a Canadian is probably the best female tennis player on earth right now at age 19, has a chance to win a few more of these, to be around for a while, to do, you know, has already done something that no Canadian's ever done before, and it's just the beginning. That's different, you know, and that's kind of the beauty of this is the person who was least surprised by it in some ways was Bianca Andreescu, because she's pretty darn confident. But I think the whole country was, this is a kind of a bonus surprise in the sporting calendar. I don't think anybody was sitting there 4 months ago saying, boy, I can't wait to see what Bianca Andreescu does in the U.S. Open. It's all happened in a few weeks. And that's different, and it's cool. It's, you know, it's part of why it feels so fresh and so fun.
And it's interesting. She's very relatable. We talked about it last week. In that kind of the grittiness that she has, she's a fighter. She fights back. She's never out of it. But she talks about Canada whenever she's given an opportunity. She was on all these shows. She's on Fallon doing these shows yesterday, and she's talking about Canada, and like John Tory. No one knows John Tory. Isn't she talking about people that she's Shania Twain? And it's like, she's just so unabashedly Canadian. And I think she looks like the girl next door. She looks like she could be your neighbor's kid, that sort of thing. She was very easy to relate with and to get behind.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, look, she hasn't been famous long enough to have kind of developed a patter, right? A shtick. She doesn't have cliches. She hasn't been doing this long enough. She hasn't done enough interviews to have kind of, so what comes out of her is natural. And she sounds like a 19-year-old. It's, you know, like there are times when she doesn't quite have the words to describe what's going on, but I don't blame her. Like, I'm not sure I'd have the words to describe what was going on if I was suddenly put in the position that she's in. And she is gritty and tough and all of those kind of good Canadian cliches about sports. But I think the other thing about her is she's really good. You know, this is not just a kind of a triumph of determination and grit. Like, she has game.
Yeah.
She plays a very smart, very sophisticated game of tennis. You know, there's a lot of kind of, especially on the women's side, there's a lot of kind of robotic players who just kind of sit at the baseline and just get everything back, you know, like just like a metronome. And she's got the power game, obviously. She's really, you know, she hits the ball as hard as anybody outside of Serena. But it's the other stuff she can do, the spin that she can put on the ball, the drop shots, the thinking part of her game. That's what's going to sustain her. You know, that's why she's got a chance to do this for a while, because, you know, grit and determination only get you so far. And you know, and God love her for not being afraid, you know, not being intimidated, and all the times, even in just within that tournament where you saw her kind of fight back, and she'd have a little wobble or her serve desert her for a bit. You know, even in that last set against Serena when she blows the 4-1, 5-2 lead, and it's 5-5 and the crowd's going crazy. Yeah, she has a deep reserve of confidence, I'll tell you. So she's athletically the total package, which is why it's worth getting excited here. You know, it's worth getting excited about the moment and just enjoying it. But when you look ahead, the reason that she's got a chance to not just be a one-hit wonder is she does a lot of stuff on the court that very, very few, if any, women can do right now. You know, there's Simona Halep and there's Ash Barty and there's some other women who are really, really good. But that number one spot in women's tennis has been a revolving door for years. You know, when Serena, you know, unless Serena was healthy and in her prime. But, you know, Bianca Andreescu's got a chance to be that and maybe stick around and be that for a while, which is, again, we're into new territory here. This is not... Not something I've seen before, not something any Canadian seen before.
I love that one angle that they had, the camera angle, kind of down the tunnel, waiting for the two ladies to come out and play. And Bianca was in the foreground, and she's got her headphones on, and she's kind of into it. And she looks over her shoulder, and there's Serena. And you wonder, any other 19-year-old might stop and kind of take an extra long look and kind of be like, ooh, there's the best in the world. She kind of looked over and said, like, oh, yeah, whatever. And then just looked back forward and then walked out onto the court. It was like, it didn't matter to her. She was so dialed in. And you're right. She is that good. That whole match, you just felt like this is going to happen. Serena is hanging on. It's not the other way around. She was in control right from the start.
Well, you know, the other thing is, and again, the reason it feels like that when you're watching her, you know, for those of us who have, you know, tuned in, you know, again, maybe from the Rogers Cup on, is that most of us have never seen her lose. You know, the last time she lost a match was on March the 1st in Acapulco, in a tournament that I guarantee you nobody watched, right? It's a third-tier tournament, and she lost there. Now, she had to retire from a match in the French Open, retire from a match in Miami, withdrew in the French. I think that's the right order. But in terms of matches she has finished, she has not lost a match since March. So for all of us who, you know, again, just got started tuning in, and that's the whole country. That's everybody. That's everybody aside from Carolyn Cameron and Arash Madani,
right,
who are crazy hardcore tennis fans. We've never seen her lose a match. So you do kind of expect her to go in there and win. One of the fascinating things is, as you said, she was shocked, obviously. She's in New York. She's won the U.S. Open. Childhood dream comes true. Or, you know, a dream from a year ago comes true. 24,000 people. She's lying on the court staring up at the sky. So she's shocked. But she was not surprised. She was not surprised at all. in her ability to win that match. And that's, boy, that kind of inner confidence and that kind of talent, that combination you do not run into all the time. She's made of pretty steely stuff, and she's really good.
Stephen Brunt, our guest here on Sportsnet. I'm looking at your notes. You had Bianca, and then Jay's heading for 100 losses. Is that happening soon? When is that happening?
Well, they have to win. They have to go 8-11 down the stretch to avoid 100 losses, because they haven't won, it feels like, in a month. So that's this last stretch, and they have a brutal schedule down there. They have a very, very hard, and they've been playing a really tough schedule. They've been playing good teams.
Yeah.
They've been playing Tampa. They played Houston. They played Atlanta. They're not that good. Guess what? And they're not. It's not like they're getting blown out every night, but you see the difference between contending teams and, again, all of those teams with something to play for, which, in baseball, the emotional part is maybe a little overrated. I don't know, it's not a rah-rah kind of sport, but those are teams that are constructed and for the postseason are going to win and they're going to get to the postseason. And the Jays are, it's audition time, right? They're going to trot out. They got a lot of guys, September call-ups, plus the young guys they brought up mid-season. Then they're just going to keep trotting different guys out there and see what they can do. So, 100 losses is not, it's not something you want to do. Mind you, the Houston Astros did it. The Astros did it 3 years in a row en route to where they are right now, which is kind of perennial contenders. I don't think the Jays will remain in those depths for that long. But this is the, people always say tear down, rebuild. We're ready for it. We're prepared for it. We know what the deal is. Go ahead and do it. But when you actually watch a team lose 100 games, it's not all that much fun. And people start to get restless and they say, well, you got to do something in the offseason. You got to bring in players to make it better. But that's not, that kind of a panicky move, unless the absolute right person is there and it makes sense. That kind of goes against the whole idea of the measured, structured, thought through, multiple season rebuild where you get, you clear out the old guys and bring in the new guys and give them time to get ready. You can't be knee jerk in the middle of this. So I'd like to say that they're bottoming out this year. And my guess would be that this is the bottom. But you never know. We could see this. They could do this all over again next year.
Stephen, do they have any? I'm a little out of tune with the Jays' prospects these days. Do they have any pitching prospects coming up here or in line that are looking good?
Yeah, you got Nate Pearson coming up, who's a top. I think he's number 7 prospect in baseball right now. Okay. Who made it as far as Buffalo at the end of the year, AAA, throws, has been clocked at 103, 104 on the gun, which is, Ooh. That's kind of freakish. And he is, he is absolutely their best pitching prospect in terms of being major league ready. They brought, you saw Kay, the guy they got from the Mets, one of the guys they got from the Mets in the Stroman trade. He pitched this week and looked good. TJ Zoik, who's first round pick. So these are all guys who are kind of auditioning. So we get to next spring. There's going to be a huge temptation to bring a guy like Pearson up to start the season. I assume they won't do that, that they'll pump the brakes a little bit. But it's not like the rotation of the future is there ready to go. They're going to have to augment it. They're going to have to bring in some other, they will have to go into the free agent market at some level. And then I would say another year, a year from now, I think we're going to be talking about them being really aggressive in the free agent market. They've got part of the next good team, but it's pretty hard to put, you need to build a core through your own system. You absolutely have to draft and develop a core. Even the Yankees do that, and they've got all kinds of money. But at some point, they're also going to have to spend. I just don't think this winter is you're going to be the winter of spending. I think, and that's going to be frustrating for fans to watch as, the Garrett Coles of the world sign other places. I don't think they open the bank vault this winter, and I actually think that's the right decision. I don't think it's quite time to do that.
There was a stretch where it looked like things had turned a little bit. They were one game above 500 for a month and a bit, and it was to the point where I suggested, this is still probably a 100 loss team, and was mocked because our Lord and Savior Bo Bichette was here to guide this team to the promised land. Do you think that this kind of falling off changes how people look at this team going into next year?
I do. A little bit. You know, it shouldn't probably, because, you know, if you're being super rational about it, you would just say, look who they were beating and look who they're losing to now. That's the difference, right? You know, and that, you know, and there've been some games where, you know, of late especially, where you kind of wondered about, you know, just kind of, you know, kind of focus. They've made some mistakes, especially defensively, that they shouldn't be making, no matter what the level of talent is. So maybe that's part of a long season starting to wear on some guys as well. But yeah, I think, you know, kind of emotionally, people were really excited. You know, Bichette came up and played like a Hall of Fame player, right? And he's great. He's still, look at his numbers, they're still really, really good. But you could kind of start dreaming on him and dreaming on the roster and saying, boy, these, you know, maybe Jacob Wagyuspak is a, you know, is a fourth starter or a third starter. And you start kind of, you know, you extrapolate a little bit too far sometimes, but it's human nature. You know, and you want to be, you know, as a fan, you want this to be over, right? You want to turn the corner and you want to start thinking about contending again. And I think maybe, you know, maybe this has been a kind of a useful correction as we head towards next spring. Because next spring will be, look, it'll be super optimistic, and it'll be the first full season of Bo and the first full season of Vladdy and the first full season of Biggio. And you'll see Gurriel has established himself as an outfielder. And again, that's the other thing, by the way, that's happened the last few weeks, is that Gurriel's been hurt. You know, and that shouldn't be discounted because he's been excellent. But there's a temptation in the spring to see all things as being possible. And that's when you start maybe, you know, thinking, well, let's promote everybody. Let's, Pearson's your opening day starter, and let's do it, and let's go for it. And it's, this probably is a bit of a reality check for the fans, and that may not be a terrible thing, you know, in the big picture.
I know you're a reporter and you dig for the big stories, and I'm not sure if anybody has brought it up. Mitch Marner plays for the Leafs, but he does not have a contract.
Is that right? I hadn't heard that. Sorry, I missed that. Is that right?
I feel like that would be hugely impactful on the Leafs season. Just something to think about.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll look into that one today, because sure. that's a shocker, man. Yeah. How could that possibly happen?
I know. Yeah. Well, we're here to help you, buddy. Here to help you, because I know, man. Yeah. Good to talk to you.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
On Thursday, we will we'll tee up Stampeders Ticats.
Awesome. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, we can do that.
Sounds good.
I would be happy to do that.
Perfect. We'll talk then.
All right. See you guys.